Going to begin the second discussion of the second essay in 1 Corinthians. The second essay is about, men and women, sex, that sort of thing. And what is the Christian ethical framework, the foundation and framework surrounding those things. This time we're going to discuss three specific issues that were going on in the Corinthian church that Paul has to deal with before he can really get to the bottom of things. These three things are what the Corinthian church may have thrown back at Paul as excuses or distractions to not address the more fundamental problems that were going on. And these three things are discussed in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6b through chapter 6, verse 8. There are a number of ways that scholars and commentaries have arranged the material that includes this current passage. Most present it as a problem of sexual immorality, specifically incest, and then there is a separate topic regarding lawsuits and legal wrangling that was going on inside the church. We are following mostly what Dr. Ken Bailey has put together here, and in the form of this second essay, the topic of this second essay, as mentioned, it was men and women in the human family. The first part of this essay, beginning with chapter 4, verse 17, and actually going all the way through this current passage for this week, is immorality in the church and how the church is supposed to deal with those things. And this week's section is a subsection, a parenthetical section of that first main block. Three roadblocks dealing with leaven, immorality, and the law courts. So a brief review of the earlier section, the first part. And the modern reader zeroes in on sexual immorality as the main issue of this entire section. Specifically the problem of, quote, incest. And this problem of incest was specifically in regards to a permanent sexual relation between a son and a stepmother. This can be seen in one of two ways. It could have been a case of that also involved adultery, in which case the father was still alive and married to the stepmother. And the son was having sexual relationships with the stepmother while the father was still married and alive. That's one way that some scholars, some commentaries explain the problem, why it was immoral. And that would be an obvious case of immorality.
Right. However, in that situation, it wouldn't be so much because she's his stepmother. It would be more because she's already married.
Yeah, the problem is, with that view, is that adultery is never mentioned in this passage. It's sexual immorality. And other commentaries discuss the language surrounding the description of this problem and conclude that the father is either dead or no longer married to the stepmother. And so it is not a case of adultery, but a case of behavior and practice against the sexual mores and the traditions and the laws that were in that culture, both Roman and Jewish. Both Roman and Jewish laws and traditions forbade this type of relationship. The Romans often turned a blind eye. So, Western Christians tend to zero in on that as the primary issue that Paul is addressing here. However, as we read through it and discussed it, that's not the main issue. That is a symptom of a bigger issue. The big issue in Paul's mind, and that perpetuating not just this problem but other problems, is that there is arrogance among some members of that church, and there is a lack of community accountability in regards to the arrogance that is going on and the symptoms that arise from it. As we read this essay, we can speculate that there was a powerful and vocal group within the church that condones this particular relationship because they are now supposedly free to do whatever they want. In other words, there can be no laws or tradition that promotes a certain type of acceptable behavior. They are free to cast off all restraint.
Mm-hmm. And Jesus did cast off some of the restraints and reject some of the laws and traditions of the day. But that doesn't mean he said that you can ignore all the rules of morality in your culture.
Another problem is that there is a larger and probably larger and a silent portion of the church that has done nothing in regards to these problems that have arisen. They are perhaps afraid, fearful of speaking out. So Paul condemns behavior of all three parties, the individual specifically pointed out in regards to this immorality, the arrogant party who is condoning this behavior, and by their silence, the group that is not doing anything. In effect, they too are condoning this behavior. But Paul is particularly incensed at the ones who are arrogant because they are exercising their coercive powers to silence those who may dare disagree. And obviously the silent are at fault because they fear the power of men over the power of God. And they have failed to take responsibility for their community. As we discussed in our reading of the chapter from misreading Scripture with Western eyes last week, in Paul's culture, in the Roman and Jewish culture of that time, the community determined what is appropriate and what is not.
So I missed out on that one, the reading through Western. But I got some of that when I listened to that article on NPR about this guy that did studies of traditional society. Mm-hmm. And so I listened to like 40 minutes of this guy's deal.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah,
it was very interesting.
Uh-huh. Yeah, in that culture, and in many non-Western cultures today, individuals do not decide what is right and wrong. Their laws do not prescribe or proscribe, but rather they describe what is already accepted by the community.
And in our culture, it's assumed that our conscience will tell us what is
correct.
Wrong. And in that culture, the
conscience is not assumed. In fact, they don't think there is a conscience for that matter. The community is the conscience.
The community is supposed to tell
Well, but it's not. I mean, it's so obviously it isn't perfect either way, though.
Right? No, no, it's
right.
An extreme on either side has problems.
Yeah.
So
in one way, you're taking individuals down to a almost barcode type life,
right?
Or you're going to the other extreme of like. There's no community at all, and every person is completely responsible for themselves.
In a law-based society where law is primary, there is no room for individual circumstance. Law must be applied consistently,
but
and fairly.
None of our law-based society works that way, though. Whenever we mandate any type of a law that is a blanketed situation, our court system immediately changes the blanket situation into an individual practice by hiring a lawyer and having a trial for that individual. Because if there's a case where you are convicted, I should say, not necessarily tried, but the conviction part is always dealt out differently depending on how your case goes. So we don't, even at that point when we try to have justice through our law, it's still tainted by the fact that we take it to an individual level by the end of the...
It is to some degree, but in most Western societies, there is very little room compared to an Eastern society. An Eastern society can disregard law altogether. And hand down a judgment that is very much, appropriate may not be the right term, but is tailored for that. You know, they are free to disregard law because law does not prescribe or proscribe. Law describes.
And just if the community as a whole feels like what the person did was basically tolerable, then it's just, whatever, we'll deal with
correct.
It, and he'll go home and everybody's happy, or vice versa, you know, we'll string him up and send him out of town.
Yeah, in a Western society, even if, you know, a killing, a homicide is, you know, society can see that it is completely justified, for whatever reason, that person has to serve.
Still has to go through the justice system. Well, yeah, that's the whole saying of village justice is swift. There's a saying that village justice is swift, and it was because of the community's effort to... Right, it was like, you know, that was when, you know, the town would come up and politely ask the sheriff to move out of the way.
Yeah, on the other hand, in a completely... law doesn't exist where the community is the law. The problem there may be that the community may have its interests so focused on protecting itself that it feels it can do whatever it wants or needs to do, regardless of how it may affect other communities.
Yeah.
And if someone feels their own conscience is saying, what's going on here is wrong, I have to do differently, then the community may come down on that person and destroy them.
We discussed that prior to the Christian era, around the 4th century, 3rd, 4th century BC with Plato. Plato began to explore the idea that the individual does have a conscience. But that idea had not made its way into general society in Rome yet. Now, Paul may have been familiar with some of those things. And I think what he is trying to do is he's trying to balance kind of the
personal responsibility with community responsibility.
Yeah. And I think that in that way, Paul is saying that Christian freedom, you're getting it wrong. Freedom is not the absence of restrictions, but the ability to do what is good. Now, for Paul,
The ability to follow your own conscience and do
to some extent. The community is free, but its freedom is not the casting off restrictions, but it is now free to do what is good. So in this first part, Paul's directive to the community was that they must come together in a public meeting in order to shame the immoral man. Because in Paul's culture, individuals do not know what is right or wrong. And shaming is the means by which the community communicates what is and isn't appropriate as a member of that community.
And shaming was a constructive practice, not a you're bad, we don't like you practice.
Right.
Shaming was a practice of instructing someone that what they're doing is wrong.
Shame is a good thing.
It's more like an intervention then.
Shame
it's
is a good
like
thing.
Like they're taking the community together to address the person, like without attacking them per se, but bringing them to this understanding that hey, look, you know.
Yeah, an intervention is what they're looking for.
It's kind of like that because they're not exactly hanging the person, they're really just trying to bring out that.
No.
Yeah, shame is a method of the community uses to say we care about what's going on in our family.
And it also talked about how someone is shameless. If someone is shameless, that's someone who doesn't know right from wrong.
Someone who doesn't know right from wrong, and the community doesn't care.
Someone who doesn't care if they, whether or not they honor the community.
And in a community.
So that's like the worst possible. That's like the biggest thing that they can do to somebody is consider them shameless.
Yeah.
Because that's like casting them completely out of the society that they live in. It's just like, oh, well, you're too far gone. We've seen what you've done. We have no way to deal with you.
Don't care about doing what is right.
In a collectivist culture, an individual realizes that if the community has taken the time to shame them, their desire is to return to the good graces. In an individualistic culture, shame or excommunication means, they don't want me.
Right.
And so I will go, I won't have anything to do with them either, and I'll go do whatever I want.
Right.
So in a Western society, shame and excommunication doesn't work or doesn't have its
effect
that the biblical culture intended.
Right. Well, we really don't have any means. We've struggled for centuries with how to address something in our society and keep the person in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's always the punitive effort is the only way we have. It's like, okay, well, you've done this wrong, so we have to punish you with something so that you understand what you've done instead of just addressing that you've done something wrong, change it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really do that anymore.
Yeah, well, again, in a law-based society, the violation of law, the punitive aspect is always, if you violate law, then there's punishment. Law doesn't leave room for rehabilitation.
Right. And so, that whole saying is, like, when you watch the TV parents telling their child, instead of the child says, well, am I in trouble? Am I going to get in trouble? The parent says, no, I'm just disappointed in you. And so that's always But yeah, so that's kind of what, there's a small analogy basically of kind of what we're looking at in a way.
Yeah, I think in Western society, in a law-based society, we have a sense that there's something wrong with it.
Right.
No, we still want some of this collectivist aspect where, you know, right and wrong isn't necessary. Law cannot prescribe it. It can only describe based on circumstances. See, the Bible is often seen as a book of laws. You know, this prescribes what your relationship to God is supposed to be. Whereas the other way of looking at it is it describes throughout history the Jewish and early Christian relationship with God at that time with their understanding.
But it's not a law-based description. That's what our hang-up is with law, is that we try to write every scenario into a law that is supposed to be governed by that law. And what happens is all too often that almost it'd be like somebody being able to predict the future, because you cannot know every aspect of a situation that somebody gets into to having broken that particular law.
I think most people in our culture agree that you can't actually describe all of what is right and wrong in law. There are going to be situations that break the law but are right. And
that's why they talk about the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law.
But still, oftentimes there will be punishment for breaking the law because the law says so, even though society agrees that what a person did was right. I remember years ago hearing about someone, husband had a disease like ALS or something, and he knew that he was going to lose his mobility, his ability, and at that point he wanted to die, and he recorded a video saying, at that point, I want my life to take a shoot. And that is my choice, that is what I request, that is what I want. This was, of course, before you could move to Oregon and get a pill. But so when the time came, that is what happened. And she used the video in her defense, but it didn't matter. She had broken the law. She had broken a big law. And she paid the penalty for many years. But they knew ahead. She knew ahead of time that she might
We look at Leviticus and Numbers, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, all the sacrificial laws, and we jump to the conclusion that sacrifices were a penalty for breaking some kind of law. Mm-hmm. It's not what they were. Sacrifices were to return to the graces of the community. It was to offer a gift to God, to the priests, in order to restore that brokenness that results, that ostracization from community that occurs when you break community norms.
And there was also an illustration that this is what happens when we go outside of what's acceptable. It causes things to happen. And this illustrates some of what happens.
So Paul is working in this church at this time to try to rein in the sides, like the flying from one handle to the other.
Yeah.
He's trying to just centralize that a little bit and put it back.
The Corinthians,
it seems like he's always doing that.
Well, it's because
he's on one end trying to get.
We wouldn't take time to write letters unless there was something really going on.
So he went from trying to make people understand Christians to trying to make Christians understand Christianity.
Uh huh. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I mean,
at one point he's saying the laws are really not that big a deal. You can eat whatever you want. It's not a big deal. And here he's going, what are you doing? Forsaking all of the cultural laws that.
Right. So he
in our community.
Yeah, he's on the other end now, trying to stop the freight train on the other side.
Yeah.
Well, that's the introduction to essay two. Now we get to the first obstacle, which is leaven. 1 Corinthians 5, 6, second half through verse 8. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Cleanse out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, as you really are unleavened. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Let us therefore celebrate the festival, not with the old leaven, the leaven of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So, Paul switches gears abruptly and talks about the metaphor of leaven.
Why does he do that?
Well, let's start with the modern reading. Modern reading usually identifies this little leaven with the sexual immorality that was described in chapter 5, verse 1. But we have to ask, is that Paul's intent? And the answer is probably not. Paul explains leaven in verse 8 of chapter 5 as malice and evil. And he doesn't talk about immorality as leaven. Malice and evil, which is a much broader topic.
Arrogance?
Could be. Malice. From which one is this? Note 6, C note 3. Malice's complete expository dictionary. This, the word translated as malice is kakia in Greek, which means malice, evil, wickedness, primarily in quality or baseness. Much of the New Testament views kakia as a force that breaks or destroys fellowship. It's not necessarily specific behaviors or specific sins that Western Christianity might be preoccupied with, but it's more of a quality, an attitude that destroys fellowship.
Resentment.
The word translated evil, this is from the Enhanced Strong's Dictionary, this is poneria, meaning depravity. It can also mean malice. But it has the sense of plots. Something intentional.
So the scheming and conniving then inside the community.
Yeah.
To harm the individuals that have done you wrong.
Yeah, you can see that Paul is concerned is not with the individual immoral man.
Right.
But with the community in general.
And how they address and how they're addressing the immoral man.
Yeah.
Okay. So the corrupt little small towns that are attacking these sometimes downtrodden people that maybe or may not have a situation that condones the like full-on badgering of the higher-ups in the town, making them feel like they're not good enough or something.
On the other hand, what is the unleavened bread? It's defined as sincerity and truth, implying transparency and harmony. And Paul picks that back up from essay one, which dealt with the problem of divisions. He's looking for harmony, harmony and unity. He's looking for transparency in their dealings. Another question that we might ask is Paul's primary concern with the leaven, or is he concerned with the dough and the bread? In other words, is he concerned primarily with the sins, with the wickedness and the evil, or is he concerned with whatever the dough and the bread represents. And the answer is probably his concern is with the dough and the bread and the way, you know, the people, the community. Because he writes in verse 7, you are a new lump. You are unleavened.
So the bickering about the right and wrong isn't what he cares about. He doesn't care whether you wear white shoes after Labor Day or whatever. It's all about just community being together on whatever their decisions are that they're making.
But in this community, there appears to be a powerful minority that's saying, we can do whatever we want. We don't have to follow the rules anymore. This guy can marry his stepmother, and we don't care because we can do as we please now. And Paul is concerned with them.
They're breaking from the larger community.
Yeah, they're leaving off all possible restrictions and going way too far. Yeah, burning their bridges, going too far, and leaving behind most of the community who's saying this isn't right, but we don't know what to do about it.
So Paul continues, let us, as the bread of Passover, celebrate the festival with the unleavened bread. Paul may be looking backwards to his first essay on unity, and he is also looking forwards to the fourth essay, where he speaks about the Eucharist or the communion and how the Corinthians were celebrating it, eating of the communion inappropriately. So this little piece is speaking about a church that is united, and that's represented by the bread.
Is the inappropriate celebration of communion where the rich people were coming in early and getting the best stuff?
Yeah.
And that's probably the same group that is condoning the immorality.
That connection can be made.
And they're leaving the scraps for the poorer people who have to wait till after work to come.
So this is all still kind of the same as the community in any modern era, all the way from then till now, where you have a community that you are or aren't allowed to do things, and the community will shame those that are or aren't doing something, but that there's always a faction of that community that can actually do whatever they want to,
right,
without being, and they're not that they're shameless, it's just that they set the bar for the shame. Mm-hmm. So they are continued and let to do as they please. Like, a lot of that reminds me of this town in the 80s where basically if you were a large, well-known fisherman, you could or do whatever you wanted to, and
the rules didn't apply.
The rules didn't really apply. You were allowed to drink and smoke and do things that were illegal, but because of the amount of prowess or presence you had here, that was okay. And now that our town is dealing with some issues like that, there's still that group of people that want their party favor but don't want everybody else to have to, they don't want to look at everybody else that can't handle it or isn't making anything from it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's still going on today. I think that in today's society we would still be dealing with this exact problem if that's
and
what Paul's
addressing.
And we
might still have teenagers who think that they should be able to get drunk and do drugs and do as they please because their family.
Well, yeah.
The kids get it and the kids assume it and think it should still be that way, kind of thing.
Well, that, I'm more so saying that that it sounds like we have an issue here where Paul is saying, look, we're supposed to be a community that's looking at each other, that's taking effort in one person to bring them back into the fold. There shouldn't be a bar over here that gets to do whatever they want, and then when somebody does something wrong, they all come together and tell him that he's doing something wrong.
Yeah.
But these guys are all doing whatever they want all the time.
How Paul opened this second essay is he appeals to a tradition that was given to the Corinthians. And the tradition is the gospel of the kingdom of God. So Paul has already taught the Corinthians what the kingdom of God looks like, what the family of God looks like, and how that community looks like. And Paul is saying, writing, reminding the Corinthians that of what they were taught by saying, by writing here that what's happening there doesn't look like what it's supposed to look like.
This isn't what you were taught.
Paul has taught each of his church, the churches that he started, this is what the family, the community looks like. And part of that event is that when groups, individuals or groups deviate from that picture, then the community is responsible for bringing them back.
And that's why he was, to some extent, saying that the people that were quiet were at fault,
yeah,
just as much as the people that were doing it,
yeah,
were at fault. Because that's where we get into, you know, worrying about the power of the people versus believing in the power of God to take care of those that would maybe stand in front of what is wrong.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, a little more on the bread here. Is it coincidence that Paul begins with lumps of dough and ends with bread? Notice that he considered the Corinthians immature in his first essay. Even though they had been given all the gifts necessary to help them mature, they had failed to appropriate it, and so they were still immature. In other words, they're still dough. At the same time, he never did question their belonging to Christ. You know, same thing in essay 1. He fully declared that they were part of the family of God, just immature. And so he can say here in essay 2 that you really are unleavened. Even though they may act in ways that are not appropriate, he can still tell them, you really are unleavened. That's their identity. But, like in essay 1, he warns them that going down a certain path, in this case, the leaven, the bad attitudes, can infect the entire community. In essay 1, he wrote that if strife left unchecked, it will destroy the church. And then it seems like this whole idea of the Passover lamb, the cross of our Passover lamb is kind of like the oven. Just as in essay 1, Paul sees the cross event as the one and only thing that will bring the church into unity and harmony. The cross of Christ in essay 1 was the wisdom, the true wisdom that will mature the doughy church into bread, that will bake the dough into bread. This event is described as shameful and tragic in the world's eyes, essay 1. But for the Christian, it is a cause for celebration. It's the source of power, it's the source of strength, it's the source of wisdom. And what is it about bread? Well, bread, once baked, is safe from further contamination. Now, once you bake it, it's not going to get infected by leaven. That's
it
where
it can't take hold.
Yeah.
A little yeast might get on it, but it can't get into the bread and make it.
Now we want bread that has yeast in it, so it'll rise.
Let the church arise.
So Paul's point here may be that when the church embraces the cross and lives out its meaning, Christ keeps her safe from evil infiltrating her. This is another echo of an idea taken from the first essay, where Paul writes that the temple or the church of God, of Christ, will be protected. No, it will be saved. There is no question. That's the first obstacle in regards to leaven. The second obstacle is associations. He writes, "I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people, not at all meaning the sexually immoral of this world, or the greedy and swindlers or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. But now I am writing to you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of brother if he is guilty of sexual immorality or greed, or is an idolater, reviler, drunkard, or swindler, not even to eat with such a one."
Why would you have to go out of the world to find immoral people?
No, in order to not associate with worldly people, you would have to go out of the world.
But then he says
that is what the Corinthians were asserting based on a misinterpretation of what Paul had written to them earlier.
And then, okay, so
you can skip 1 C and D and it would still make perfect sense. I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people. Or actually you do need C, but you can skip D. Not at all meaning the sexually immoral of the world, since then you would need to go out of the world.
Oh, this is, I wrote not meaning, I wrote meaning. What's that mean?
So, what Paul... Oh, we'll continue here.
So does he mean it's okay to associate with the sexually immoral of the world?
We'll continue.
Okay.
Hold your questions. So, he's in these verses 9 through 11 of chapter 5, Paul is talking about associations with people without and within the church. Two separate things. There was an earlier letter, non-extant, we don't know what it contained, in which the Corinthian church had misconstrued. Paul's concern with the text here is mission. What Paul is saying in the first part is mission cannot be performed if the church refuses to associate with the world.
Okay.
In the second part, Paul is writing mission cannot be performed if the church misrepresents Christ.
So he's saying it's okay to go out into the world and associate with sinners.
Yeah.
But when he says don't associate with sexually immoral people, he's saying don't... the people who are part of your family should be moral. I see. If someone's immoral, you should tell them they're doing wrong.
Sinners should be correctly identified as such.
So modern readers again zero in on the phrase sexual immorality.
Mm-hmm.
It's mentioned three times in this few verses, so therefore it must be important. Right? Maybe. Maybe not.
So he's actually alluding to the idea that, like, churches that segregate themselves from society completely and only associate with
a monastery,
themselves. Yeah, or, you know, Amish or any, uh-huh. There's lots of churches, modern churches, that have gone to a point where there is the only people they associate with are the people within the confines of their belief. They have no mission. They're not doing anything in the world to represent God to other people because they don't associate with those other people in any way, shape, or form.
That's one of the reasons the Mennonite broke from the house.
So then you have
secluding themselves.
Paul saying, now in order to consider yourself a church, that's one part of your mission. The other part of your mission is to uphold the face of God. So you have to actually act like that.
Yeah. So
just because you're free doesn't mean you get to go sleep around or have a good time and then say, oh, but by the way, I'm a Christian.
Yeah. And just we need to keep in mind that sexual immorality, as referenced in this entire essay, is just the tip of a much larger problem, which is arrogance.
The arrogance that I'm free from sin, so I can do whatever I want.
It's arrogance and power. Those are the two things that Paul mentions in the introductory
the
part.
The power of the powerful few over the wishes of the...
Yeah, so that's not to say that sexual immorality is not a problem, but it isn't Paul's main concern. It may have been a large concern of the Corinthian church, in which it used that criterion, however she defined it, however the church defined it at that time, what sexual immorality meant, as a basis of whether or not to associate with non-Christians. Which, in many ways, is the same problem that the modern church has. Mm-hmm. Now, we tend to categorize sexual sins, quote, sins, as somehow a separate category from all other sins.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And if you've done that, well, sure, we've sinned, but we don't do that. We won't associate...
The church has
your sexual
always tended to keep away, keep at arm's length those who are... who don't fit the sexual standards of a Christian community.
Well, all of American society does that.
To some extent. Less so in parts of American culture than we used to.
Right.
But traditionally, Americans have put people in boxes based on their sexuality. Mm-hmm. And said, we will associate with these people, we won't associate with those people, period.
Mm-hmm. So what Paul does is correct, he, in these verses, corrects the Corinthian church's misunderstanding and misapplication of what he had written earlier. He writes that the church's concern with morality and behavior should be limited to within herself, mm-hmm. not without. He also writes that power, position, status, and influence doesn't matter. Anyone in the community of believers who is guilty of unchristian behavior must be called out, in other words, shamed and removed from community.
And in that situation, and in their culture, we talked about how removing them from the community was a way of trying to get them to see that what they're doing is unacceptable with the hope of bringing them back in.
Right. Because there is no individual identity. So a person, if he is removed from the community, suddenly has no identity, and so his first response normally would be, so what do I need to do to return?
What do I have to do to get back in? Whereas in our churches today, if you kick someone out for doing what you think they shouldn't do, they're going to either not go into any church at all or just join a different one. So I don't think that particular method of trying to convince someone they're doing wrong is useful. I think we have to use different methods than what they used. But, yes.
So in the second part of this, these sets of verses here, Paul lists vices. Lists of vices is common in literature of the period. He lists six specific vices. Western rhetoric usually places importance on the first item, unless explicitly noted that the order is reversed. That's how we think. Now, if it comes first, it's what's important. Roman Greek rhetoric often used these virtue vice lists of five items, with a sixth item summarizing the first five. The five are not in any particular order, nor do they assume an exhaustive list. They're just five examples. So what we want to do is we want to take special note of some of these words. First of all, in the middle is this word greed. Mm-hmm. A covetous or an avaricious person, one who defrauds for the sake of gain. And if this 5+1 rhetoric is present, if Paul is using this here, then swindler would be the summarizing concept. It has an intentional motive of defrauding and destroying, perhaps in a violent manner. And one of the underlying themes of this letter is that Paul is trying to point out to the Corinthian church is that you're destroying yourself. And so it would make sense that, you know, this idea of swindling, with the connotation of destruction, would be present as the last item. It also has the idea of extortion. And extortion has the connotation, the concept of arrogance and the misuse of power, the theme of this particular essay. And then in this current subsection of this essay, Paul is going to return to this idea. He uses slightly different words, but similar ideas in chapter verse 6-8, when he returns to Corinthian church's current behavior, but you yourselves wrong and defraud, even your own brothers. So what Paul appears to be doing is, by mentioning sexual immorality, he is pointing out the Corinthian church's overemphasis on a particular item, but also the problem, a specific symptom that is present in the church. But then he lists four other items, and then he gets to the last item, the sixth item, which is the real problem. His directive is to not to even eat with such a person. Now, for us, meals are
sustenance,
and they're not particular. They don't connote any particular significance usually,
unless someone is invited to a special dinner.
Paul is not talking about casual meals here. He's talking about communion. On the other hand, communion was not a separate event or a meal or a ritual. It was a Christian fellowship meal. It's when Christians got together to eat. They had communion. So it happened regularly, perhaps daily, in the early days of the Christian church. And so what Paul is writing here is that you are a family. You're having a family meal. when you include someone in these meals, you're saying you are accepting their representation of community.
And we were talking recently about how it was seen, and maybe still is in some cultures, seen as inappropriate or unhealthy to eat by yourself. Eating is supposed to be a community or a family event, and to just snack throughout the day by yourself or to eat alone was seen as not good. Not good for you or whatever. And in that case, to not let someone in on the family meal or communion would be, they're going to have to eat by themselves. And that would be distressing.
Yeah, to not be a part of community is essentially to be dead. Paul's instruction here to not even eat with such a one is to declare that person dead.
But with hope of resurrection.
And so this idea of communion, this meal, ties back to the preceding verses about Passover and the bread. And it's call for unity and removing the leaven. Whatever is infecting the community needs to be removed. Paul's point here is that internal corruption or leaven is far more insidious and dangerous than external influence. Paul's concern is that the church community act responsibly so her mission is not impaired. With the sub-point is that freedom is in Christ is not reckless living. We have the church knows how it's supposed to appear. It knows its mission. Its mission is to represent Christ. And so it needs to remove anything that misrepresents. Then we get to the problem of lawsuits, the third obstacle. It's the longest set of verses in this subsection of SA 2. Chapter 5, verse 12 through chapter 6, verse 8. For what have I to do with judging outsiders? Is it not those inside the church whom you are to judge? God judges those outside. Purge the evil person from among you. When one of you has a grievance against another, does he dare go to law before the unrighteous instead of the saints? Or do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world is to be judged by you, are you incompetent to try trivial cases? Do you not know that we are to judge angels? How much more, then, matters pertaining to this life? So if you have such cases, why do you lay them before those who have no standing in the church? I say this to your shame. Can it be that there is no one among you wise enough to settle a dispute between the brothers, but brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers? To have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? But you yourselves wrong and defraud even your own brothers. Well, there were lawsuits within the community. The community at least some in the community were taking matters to outside legal courts. As we recall, Paul, in this culture, the community defines its boundaries. The community defines what is and isn't appropriate. It is assumed that outsiders do not know the community, therefore it is not properly equipped to adequately render judgment on community matters.
The outsiders are outside of the community, therefore they don't have authority to say what is acceptable in this community.
I think Paul's saying more not outside the community or outsiders or anything like that. He's talking about non-believers of Christ. He's saying
right.
that you are a group of Christians that believe in the cross. You're uh-huh. covered under the cross.
And so
and you're willing to, when you have a problem with each other that are covered under the cross, to go completely outside of that coverage and find somebody else that has no idea and doesn't care about you as a Christian to change or to garner your outcome of your situation that you have. And obviously Paul's pretty ticked about that, because basically why is it that you're going to go to the law, the courts, when you have the saints and the cross behind you to solve these problems within each other?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
The Roman justice system delegated its authority to communities. In other words, the Jews were allowed latitude to judge their own community. And they did so in their synagogues. And we see that in the Gospels, that the Jews were given a great deal of autonomy regarding their own laws. The only things that really Rome kept for itself were matters involving treason and capital crimes. And a Christian community, thus, as part of, at this point, it was still considered Jewish. It would be expected by all that Christians would judge their own problems, particularly in matters of religion and morality.
So for those, if there were lawsuits that dealt in morality or something like that between two people, say adultery or something like that, and they took that outside of the church, that would be a big no-no per se, or not no-no, but that would be a big scar on the face of the church for not being able to work within itself.
Well, you were talking before about how maybe some of the people in the church were hoping that Paul would declare Batman evicted from the church so that they wouldn't have to do it. This comes back to, it's your responsibility.
Yeah, the community in some way is not taking responsibility for itself. The modern reading of this set of texts is that frequently is that Paul is writing because Paul doesn't want the church to embarrass herself and damage her reputation by airing dirty laundry in public. Mm-hmm. In other words, all of this, the problems that are going on, now they're it's private to the church. The outside world doesn't need to know about it.
Keep it a secret.
Yeah. Thus the command to deal with it internally.
Mm-hmm.
And quietly remove the offending individual. And many commentaries follow that line of reasoning. But the reality, in my opinion, now this is my opinion, based on the context as well as what we've been studying in what the culture is about, the reality is probably that the public already knows everything that's going on within the church. Privacy is a modern concept. We tend to read it into Scripture where it doesn't exist. The public expects the church to deal with her own problems. And when the church resorts to outsiders to judge her problems, she is in effect saying, I won't or can't deal with this problem. So by going outside the church, outside, the church's reputation is going to be destroyed, but not in the way that we think it is, by airing dirty laundry, but rather she loses honor because she is refusing or cannot behave in a manner that a community is expected to behave, to take responsibility for herself.
The public already knows that the church is doing wrong by going outside saying, we're doing wrong and we can't do anything about it.
Yeah, she loses honor. She is shamed.
The community is asking its superiors to enforce its own laws.
But they're not even superior. The church is an entity unto itself.
Right.
And they're putting someone else in a superior position.
Yeah, she's asking the church, by going outside, is asking a third-party arbitrator to come in.
Wow.
And try to figure out, work through the mess.
It's asking someone else to enforce
their own
laws. And they're supposed to be enforcing their own laws themselves.
Not only that, but by arrogantly asserting that her freedom means no responsibility, in other words, no, I'm not going to take responsibility for what happens. The church is identifying herself as a threat to Roman rule and order.
Oh.
The community, by not taking responsibility for her own order, is a threat to the greater society.
Jesus advocated freedom, and he broke some of the rules, but he always took responsibility for what he did. These people are running rampant.
And finally, a quiet removal of the offender won't do anything to heal the fractures in this church community. In this culture, all shaming has to be public.
Mm-hmm.
The public has, the entire community has to be involved. It can't be just a small part saying, we don't want you anymore. So Paul is admonishing the Corinthian church to take responsibility for herself. He wants the church to act as a responsible member of society. And thus Paul calls on the entire community to come together to purge the evil from among them. The church must act as one agreed. Judgment and purging or shaming is not a private affair, and the process of coming together and acting as one voice will bring unity. Again, this is something that probably won't work in modern Western society. We value our individual opinions too much. We value our independence too much. But in this culture, it works, because independence and individual opinions are subject to the community.
The community was primed, and people valued...
Yeah, people valued harmony and belonging.
They valued belonging to the community.
Paul tells the Corinthian church that they are equipped to judge. Now, outsiders are not equipped to judge church members. And the theological basis that Paul gives for this is that the church as a whole will judge the world and angels. And so Paul shames the entire church in order to remind her of her community responsibilities. The word in the process to judge does not mean to condemn or punish, but to define what is good and evil, what is acceptable and what is not. And then he sarcastically refers to their supposed wisdom. They've been claiming all along that they're wise.
So if
you're claiming to be wise, why can't you judge among yourselves? Another way of shaming.
You say you're wise, you say you're ready for the deep things, but then you have to get an arbitrator who doesn't even part of our set of our moral or of our morality to judge our rules. Doesn't make sense, huh?
What is Paul dealing with in this set of verses regarding lawsuits? Is he talking still on the topic of sexual immorality or the incest of chapter 5, verse 1? Is he talking about arrogance? Or is he talking about some other lawsuits that are happening among the believers? We've already talked about the sexual immorality as an example and a symptom of the arrogance that was a problem in the church. And it appears that lawsuits too are a symptom or a result of arrogance. Perhaps those in power in the church were refusing to listen to those who wanted to take action on this immoral behavior. Or those who wanted to take action were too fearful to force the church to act. Maybe some of these thought that it would be easier to get outside courts to act on their behalf. It was certainly wrong for those in power to either refuse to listen or to instill fear so that no action will be taken. That's the evil of power. On the other hand, it was also wrong for those who wanted to take action to bring in unqualified parties. The main problem of all this is that the church is in danger of failing her mission. By fostering an atmosphere where divisiveness, arrogance, immorality, and so on are tolerated, where it seems to some that only outside intervention can solve their problems, the church is already on the road to failure. Paul writes, "You're already defeated." To seek judgment from outside the believing community is to invite an outside party to shame the church. The judgment handed down will not be in the church's best interests. So Paul writes, you might as well be wronged and defrauded. The real problem is that the church is doing this to herself, wronging and the defrauding. She doesn't need to call in someone from outside to do it for her. She's doing it herself by the division, the arrogance, the pride, the power, and all these things that are happening. So even though the exact words in chapter 6, verse 8 are different, the theme, the motif, echoes chapter 5, verse 8, which uses malice and evil, and chapter 5, verse 11, which uses the words greed and reviler and swindler. Now, this idea of power, of certain individuals doing whatever they can to get whatever they want at the expense of others. Well, Paul's concern is that the believing community has so compromised herself that she has little power left to perform her mission. And the wrong solution, the wrong attitude to such a problem is someone else will take care of the problem. These sets of verses are some that are easily misused in today, misused and misapplied today. First, the misunderstanding of these passages as referring primarily to sexual sins. We've talked about how churches have seemed to develop a special category for sexual sins. Mm-hmm. And violations are pretty much the unforgivable sin. Mm-hmm. Individuals who commit sexual sins, as defined by whatever church, are treated as pariahs. Once you commit that sin, you cannot return. Or maybe they will let you attend, but you will always be looked upon with suspicion.
And they won't let you hold office in the church.
Another problem is that we seem to have the same problem as the Corinthian Christians, where we miss chapter 5, verse 10, where Paul writes that Christians are supposed to associate with immoral and evil people of the world. And we miss chapter 5, verses 12 through 13, where Paul writes, Christians have no business judging actions and motives of those outside the community of believers. For some reason, Christians are too often quick to condemn sins of those outside the church while condoning stuff that happens inside. The exact opposite of what Paul wrote to the Corinthians. Churches also often seem to misuse chapter 6, verses 1 through 7 about not bringing matters of the church to outside courts. And we miss 5, verse 13, where evil is commanded to be removed from the community. And so how does that happen in more specific ways? Well, first, religious organizations have a habit of not reporting criminal activities of church members. We fail to understand that law and justice was handled differently in Rome. Rome gave jurisdiction to communities. It's not the world we live in today. Churches today continue to assert ecclesiastical privilege over violations of civil and criminal laws. That's not how society is structured here. It may be in some parts of the world still, but here.
But a lot of what's happening is what you said, is that instead of the church governing itself, it's using it to it's using it to hide their own thing. They're not doing any of that anymore.
Paul's concern was the church needs to act as a responsible member of society.
Right.
In, when Paul was writing, it looked a certain way. If Paul were writing today in American society, it would probably sound a lot different. So what happens is, you know, there are attempts to, quote, under the defense, protect the church's reputation or God's reputation. Religious organizations tend to quiet offenses done by those in the church, particularly those invisible positions or powerful positions. They move these offenders around, or they essentially bribe the victims to keep quiet. Or if that doesn't work, appeals to the claim of reputation and don't bring lawsuits by quoting scripture, by to prevent, to coerce, and to manipulate victims from exposing offenses and crimes, essentially spiritual abuse.
So they manipulate that passage both ways to their to their benefit. Keeping secrets or keeping people quiet.
And by doing that, they go completely against what Paul was trying to get at. In this set of texts, then, Paul preemptively dealt with three excuses that the Corinthian believers might have made in regards to Paul's instructions. The first excuse is, it's just a minor thing, a minor matter among just a few individuals. Why make such a big deal out of it? It's a common excuse that churches make today. Second excuse is, we're free to do whatever we want. And the third excuse is, someone else will deal with the problem. Paul, in summarizing, I think Paul is writing about Christian maturity. Something that Paul earnestly desires for the Corinthian Christians, but he knows they're having problems with. So first, Christian maturity includes developing a community perspective. It's not all about you. It's not about just the individual, it's about the community. Christian maturity includes developing community accountability. You are responsible and accountable to one another for what happens. And finally, Christian maturity includes developing community responsibility, especially to deal with problems in appropriate ways. Not just Christian responsibility within the community, but Christian responsibility of the community as in relation to the bigger society. So the power in all of this, Paul's concern, I think, is with Christian mission. So how do you protect Christian mission? And the best way to protect and to promote Christian mission is to have a healthy Christian community. You can't have mission without a healthy community. Mm-hmm. That's Paul's perspective. A lone wolf who may have right teachings, right attitude, right behavior, everything, will, as far as Paul's concerned, will be ineffective if the community too is not representing Christ appropriately. Because for Paul, there is no individual Christian. A Christian has to belong to a family. So, these texts dealt with some very specific applications in regards to how Christians are supposed to relate to the greater society. And Paul is going to come back to that in subsequent essays as well. We talked about how that application looked in Paul's day and how it probably ought to look different in our day. Now, it's not the specifics that are important, as more of the general principle that the Christian community has to represent Christ appropriately and it has to relate appropriately to the greater society.
Which is just that it boils down to honor and respect for people, period. Your honor as a church is that if something happens to the community from your members, you have to address the community, or not, I'm saying members of community. If your member does something to society's community, the church has to address it and give that person over to society so that they can deal with it.
Right, especially today where this is a law-based society.
Right, well, then the churches nowadays tend to fold over their sins and sweep them under the carpet as quickly as possible.
Because we're not supposed to.
Because they think their shame is not...
Yeah, and what happens?
It gets worse.
Churches after churches, denominations after denominations, religious organizations after another... Eventually, something blows up.
They lose honor.
Then the result is worse than if it had been dealt with appropriately in the first place.
Right. Well, they cover it up. They keep covering it up, and it festers, and it gets bigger and bigger and blacker and nastier. And when it finally blows up, you find that the basis for this church has all this ugliness.
And see, it's not even that even though the specific problems that were covered up are bad, that's not the worst part. It's the fact that the church has covered up.
Yeah.
It loses trust. It has lost trust. That's why religious institutions are one of the least trusted entities in modern society.
Yeah. Honor and trust are both.
How is it that something that was so fresh became instantly corrupted like that, and then from really hasn't changed yet? How is it that that has happened? And it really is that, for the most part, you know, churches in general are very self-centered in their ideologies as far as what they deserve, how they deserve it, who can or can't, you know, tell them what to do.
Which
here we're given, when people are given freedom, a large portion of them tend to automatically just take that and run with it and not look at the responsibilities that go with it.
Definitely, you're not going to say that you need a new church, but it sounds like you do.